Thank you for joining us for this chapel message from the campus of Columbia International University in Columbia, South Carolina. Our mission at CIU is to educate people from a biblical worldview to impact the nations with the message of Christ.
Well, it's good to be here with you this morning, and it is with, you know, the weight and the realization of just how heavy this topic is. Where I teach at my university, I have a colleague who's a family scientist in the social sciences, and we've become good friends, and he teaches a course on human sexuality, and so we've gotten together over many years of talking, and we've offered a course for a couple of years on the Bible and sexuality as a larger topic, of which same-sex attraction, same-sex sexuality is a subsection of that. And so much of what I say today comes from the several years that we've talked and read and discussed things. It's been probably one of the most popular classes, believe it or not, at a university, most popular classes that the students have taken. They've all said, hey, everybody should have this class. Because this is a topic that I think everybody has some sort of connection to or interest to in one way or another, whether it's same-sex sexuality or just sexuality as a whole. I was thinking about it last night, and I was thinking, you know, one of the principles I try to live my life by is a saying I heard in college, and that is, nobody cares how much you know until they first know how much you care. And it's with that I try to bring this. This is one of these topics that could easily bring a lot of kind of fierce debate, a lot of complexity, a lot of issues that are involved. People may be struggling, or they may have family members, or whatever the case may be. So I want to kind of begin by setting that tone and saying, I want to make sure that everything was shrouded in the love and the grace of God. Because he is our hope and our Savior, and he is the one that we do all things for. So with that said, as I was prayerfully thinking about how to begin and how to talk about this subject, today will be primarily just some kind of foundational issues that I think are necessary for even framing the discussion. And then on Wednesday and Thursday, we'll get into kind of some of the nuts and bolts of the biblical text and how to read it and how to understand it. So to start with, right, everybody has a history. Everybody has a story. And this history includes anything that's from childhood experiences on up till now, right? But that history can include family dynamics, thoughts, ideas, things that you've read, things that you've seen. It includes the good experiences, right? Like that vacation, that family vacation at the beach, or the time that you won the game, or perhaps even your first crush. But it also includes bad experiences, like when your parents got divorced, when you fumbled the ball and lost the game, and when you were rejected by your first crush, or you embarrassed yourself. You see, your history includes your sexuality as well. For this, it may be more pronounced for some than others, but everyone has experienced the difficult, awkward, and sometimes embarrassing reality of their sexuality. It includes when you discovered the differences between boys and girls. It involves becoming aware of your own body and grappling with the feelings of sexual desire. For some, maybe many of us, it may be a very painful and soul-damaging experience of abuse or memory of molestation, unwanted groping. Some have a varied and complex history filled with experiences from kissing to intercourse, and that perhaps with several different partners. Others may have saturated their minds with thousands of pornographic images, and still others may live with this continual deep sense of shame and have sought to repress anything sexual about themselves at all. Now, I say this not to make anyone uncomfortable, too late, but merely to point out the reality that as human beings, we were created, among many other things, with sexual organs and hormones. While we were designed by God to be fruitful and multiply, we have also are a fallen race who have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. As such, our sexuality and our sexual desires are intertwined with our fallen sinful nature. Now, to be clear, I don't believe that sexuality is the defining or most important aspect of who we are as human beings, but is nonetheless a powerful and strong influence upon us. It often enslaves us when we seek to gratify the desires of the flesh. Now, we see this evidenced in our society on a daily basis, right? Things that, like the Me Too movement, which has made us aware of the magnitude and the prevalence of how men, and sometimes women, have used their leverage of power and authority to take sexual advantage of women, and sometimes men. Even in our national dialogue, right, you can't even turn on the evening news without there being a constant detailed discussion about sexual exploits or accusations. I even think we're seeing a rise in extramarital affairs, and I don't have any statistics on this. I don't have any scientific evidence to back that up, other than just I know at least a dozen people who are either currently divorced, have lost their jobs, or they're facing some other kind of consequences for adultery. And here's the worst part about it. All of them are church members or in the ministry. We even see sexual activity occurring at younger and younger and younger ages, even with the inventing of sexting. Right. So this brings us to the topic of same-sex sexuality within the current advances coming from the LGBTQI LMNOP community. I don't say that to make fun of it. I do say that to say that LGBTQI is the short version of that. There's actually a number of other letters that are attached to those. Community, there's been advances in terms of legal rights, and even you see it in terms of marriage and more in popular media, right? More and more you see same-sex either couples or same-sex identifying people in movies, television, music, even characters on the Disney Channel, right? Now, the defining strategy for the LGBTQI movement was to shift the national conversation away from morality to that of civil rights. You have to understand the way the bell has been rung that can't be unrung. It moved away from a question of morality, is this right or is this wrong, to a question of I have rights, and it's a question of civil rights. In other words, the question of who has sex with who is now often not seen as a matter of moral behavior, but justice and equal rights. Now, the result of this shift cannot be overstated. But in short, in our current cultural climate, then to make a moral assessment about someone's sexual practice is seen as immoral itself, bigoted, and hateful. Now, the ironic thing is, right, there's still, within this pluralistic atmosphere of sexual liberation, there are still very strong opinions about what clearly constitutes right and wrong regarding sexual behavior. What we ultimately see is that the current state of our popular culture in regard to sex and sexuality is a confusing state of moral chaos at best. Dennis Hollinger, in his book, The Meaning of Sex, observed, "In the midst of all this, we are a confused culture, about the limits and rights and wrongs of sexual intimacy. And he goes on to say, we are confused, I believe, for the simple reason that we have no clear conception of the meaning of sex. Now, in Hollinger's book, he's ultimately arguing, right, that we have lost the biblical foundations for understanding even the purposes for why sex was given and how we think about that. Now, I would even argue that the state of confusion comes from a number of factors, right? But the basic contours, I think we can see where it comes from when it comes to sexuality. To be sure, there has always been, throughout all of human history, a number of issues and views regarding sexual morals in Western civilization. Well, for the most part, though, our culture has been deeply influenced by the Judeo-Christian tradition, the scriptures and teachings. Now, granted, the church has often struggled with that. It's been a really uneasy and interesting read. If you ever get a chance, read what some of the early church fathers have said about these things. Things from, the harsh treatment of their own bodies to fashioning underwear out of thorn bushes. And others like Augustine, who would view sex more within the realm of a result of the fall, and therefore, even within marriage, should be practiced at a limited basis and only really for the purposes of procreation or making a baby. Now, even though the church has maintained different views and attitudes about sex, overall, they have consistently maintained that sex was reserved only for the context of a man and a woman who are married to each other, and that they should remain exclusively faithful to one another. So things like premarital sex, adultery, and same-sex sex were consistently regarded as sinful and contrary to God's design. Now, for the most part, the Judeo-Christian view regarding sex served as kind of the moral fabric of American society up until the rise of the sexual revolution. You see, the sexual revolution of the free love movement that came at a time in the 1960s when the younger generation was disillusioned by those in authority and the traditional status quo, especially regarding sexual behavior. Now, coupled with this kind of free love movement, make love, not war, and other things that were related to this, the sexual lib movement, you had fueling it the research of Dr. Alfred Kinsey, who developed a scientific approach to sexuality. And so he published ultimately what was often known as the Kinsey Report. It was made up of two separate books, The Sexual Behavior in the Human Male in 1948 and Sexual Behavior in the Human Female in 1953. And so what he did was interviewed thousands of people and asked them about very detailed questions about their experiences and their desires and so on and so forth, and then published this report. His study focused on sexual diversity also in males and females. And some of his arguments and findings were that 37% of males and 13% of females had at least some overt homosexual experience. 10% of males were more or less exclusively homosexual, and 8% of males were exclusively homosexual for at least 3 years between the ages of 16 and 55. He says 4% of males and 1 to 3% of females have been exclusively homosexual from the onset of adolescence to the time of the interview. He even developed this classification scheme to measure sexual orientation. It's commonly called the Kinsey scale, in which it kind of evaluates it in different levels. But here's the thing to know about the Kinsey Report, right? The two books known as the Kinsey Report together sold nearly a million copies and were translated into 13 different languages. The Kinsey Report is associated with the different perception in the public of sexuality and was considered part of one of the most influential scientific books of the 20th century. Now, coupled with the Kinsey Report and different attitudes about, you know, what people can do sexually, you also have the rise of the pill. The pill was a development that came about around the same period of time, the 60s and early 70s, in which, right, the pill now enabled people to be able to have sex without pregnancy. That was a big deal. You see, for the first time in history, then, sex was divorced from one of its primary purposes, that is, procreation. And keep in mind, when I use the word procreation, I mean having children. The separation of sex from reproduction, now hear me on this, the separation of sex from reproduction, right, was something that was brand new. Because now, sex was no longer about with the consequences of having children. There's always been prophylactics and other attempts to try to prevent that, right? But it shifted the attitudes, and now it made it possible for sex to be purely just a matter of recreation and choice, and not be part of that possibility of having children and moving forward. So when you remove procreation, making babies, as one of the foundational purposes of sex, it manages to create the opportunity to revisit traditional restrictions regarding same-sex sex, since procreation is impossible. Right? That's been one of the arguments in times where because you cannot have children in a same-sex sexual relationship without the intervention of medical technology or some other, you know, adoption or something else, it's not possible, right? So if sex is no longer part of having children and it's just something that you do as an expression of love and just for pleasure or for fun, it totally changes then some of the questions that people are asked then. Well, if you take having children out of the equation, then same-sex sexuality is perfectly a valid choice in that regard, right? It's then seen as something just normal and natural and acceptable. Now, to be clear, and I'm just kind of trying to state kind of the background of where kind of we are in our current society. To be clear, there's many factors that have contributed to it, right? So it's not just this or that. There's a number of things. And one of those things, I think, is partly that the American church, the evangelical church, has not done a very good job of developing a robust view of sexuality in which we've been able to talk about things. I'm not saying it hasn't been preached about, it hasn't been discussed, but there's been, overall, it's an uncomfortable topic that isn't always discussed well. So in last several generations of the 20th century, they had the True Love Waits movement, the abstinence, the purity movement, as an attempt coming from the church to say, hey, this is how we're responding to issues of sex and sexuality. But even then, I think it has limitations, because most of the focus there is on teenagers, don't have sex till you're married, right? Which is an important message to give, but it doesn't do much to really explain all the things about sexuality in the body and how to think about it from a biblical and theological perspective. You see, I'm convinced that any attempt of addressing the question of same-sex sex from a Christian and biblical perspective must be framed within a larger theological and biblical framework of human sexuality as a whole. Once again, I find myself in agreement with Dennis Hollinger, former president of Gordon Conwell Seminary, as a philosopher, ethicist. He says this, the biblical story includes sexual failure, including some seedy narratives. I don't know if you've read the Bible, but there's some really, there's some stuff in there I'm like, wow, that's, Wow. There's some stuff in there that's unpleasant, to say the least. So their stories include failure as well as faithfulness, right? It incorporates the command and principles geared toward sexual intimacy. But above all, it implicitly provides us with an overarching meaning of sex, which in turn forms the theological bedrock of any commands and principles about physical intimacy. In its meaning of sex, that we find a framework by which we make sense of our own sexuality as human beings. It is in the meaning of sex drawn implicitly from divine revelation and yet partially known from human experience and history that we discover the framework for guiding our sexual lives. In other words, here's what he's saying. When you look at the grand scale of the biblical narrative and everything that it says, it gives us a comprehensive picture. You won't necessarily find it in one command here, one command there. You gotta look at it all together, both the good, bad, and the very ugly. You have it all there. And from that emerges kind of these divine understanding from Scripture what God has intended in making us sexual beings. Because we are human beings who are sexual, and that's a divine design of us as people. And so it's from kind of understanding this larger scriptural and theological framework that we start to make sense of these things. In a more recent book by Todd Wilson, entitled Mere Sexuality, Rediscovering the Christian Vision of Sexuality, he says this: I don't think we've dealt adequately with the question of homosexuality in light of God's design for human sexuality. Instead, we have addressed the issue too narrowly, or at times exclusively in biblical and personal and practical terms. So our approach has been to ask one or two questions, a biblical question or a personal and practical question. What does the Bible really teach about homosexuality? Or how can we love homosexuals as Jesus would? He says, of course, these are important questions we should ask, but they're not sufficient to settle the issue of what we should think about same-sex relationships. We need to put the question in a larger theological context. So, here's the challenge before me in a three-day lecture series, right, is time doesn't allow us to go through all of the biblical material, all of the biblical data, and develop a very robust, comprehensive biblical theology of sexuality. But I think every time we come to any of these questions, especially when it comes to same-sex sexuality, is we have to put it within not just that particular topic, but within a larger framework of what it means from a biblical, theological background that we are sexual, and how then do we approach these particular questions about practices. And so we don't have time to develop fully that framework, but I'm operating from a framework that I've been developing for the last several years. And so been thinking about these questions, thinking about these texts. But that's something I think that's very important. Not to be a knee-jerk reaction to things that pop up in society, but to be more of proactively thinking about the bigger questions. Now, I want to kind of define some terms, kind of a word about words, if you will. As we think about this, because language matters. The words we use matter. How we phrase things matters, right? So a couple ways, and this is important. There's a difference between sex and sexuality, and I use those terms differently on purpose. So sex, when we refer to sex, we're talking about the actual activity, certain expressions or behaviors of physical intimacy. Sexuality, on the other hand, refers to our maleness and our femaleness as human beings. And as human sexual beings, whether or not they engage in sex, we're sexual beings. So we all have biological gender and then develop a sexual identity, a sexual understanding integrated with that. Right? So to put it another way, our sexuality is in the form of our bodily and physical being within the world. It certainly encompasses the emotional, social, and spiritual selves, but is related to the very way in which we as embodied beings exist in a relationship with others. So it's kind of the broader topic, and it would include everything that could fall under the category, but it's focusing primarily, right, on the physical, chemical, biological aspects of what it means to be a sexual being. Now, coupled with that, I'm going to take issue with a couple of other terms that are commonplace in our culture, and that is sexual identity and homosexuality. Both of those terms are terms that I think we need some corrective to. Now, here's what I mean by this, right? And there we go. Sexual identity is a term that basically refers to the essential sexual self-concept of an individual. But currently in our culture, sexual identity is divorced from biological sex. And biological sex does not determine sexual identity. In other words, the term sexual identity is used all the time, and it almost becomes a matter of choice. Maybe not always choice, but sometimes the way that people refer to it. I identify as this sexually, or I identify as this sexually. And it doesn't matter necessarily what your biological gender is. It's how you see yourself. Janelle Paris, a Christian anthropologist, wrote a book called The End of Sexual Identity, and I'm going to have a lot of quotes from her because it's been very important for my own understanding of some of these things. She said, "We are told that our inner sexual feelings are the measures of who our true selves are, that by knowing, exploring, and expressing our sexual desires, we become our real selves. Efforts to discipline or redirect sexual feelings for the sake of a greater cause may be seen as foolish and dehumanizing. In a book called Divine Sex, A Compelling Vision for Christian Relationships, Jonathan Grant kind of talks about this and the way that sexual identity is kind of elevated as part of who are you really? Who is your true self? Has talked about how this is ultimately coming from a value that we have in our culture of authenticity. Now, he's borrowing from the works of Charles Taylor, and he says this, that we have adopted this culture of authenticity into our mainstream society. And what he means by that is this: modern authenticity encourages us to create our own beliefs and morality, and the only rule is that we must resonate with who we are, who we feel we really are. So then the worst thing you can do is conform to some moral code that is imposed on us from the outside by our society, by our parents, by the church, or whoever else is deemed to be self-evident, is to be an imposition to take away our unique identity. What is he saying? Here's what he's saying. He's saying that everything in our culture is like, well, be who you really are. Be your true self. And you are the only one that can determine who you truly are. And if anyone tries to come and say, no, that's not okay, that's not right, he says, then that's seen as a great sin in our society because it's suppressing who your true self is. You have to be who you are, and you determine that. And that becomes one of the chief values in our culture. So my issue with using the language of sexual identity is not that I don't think that such a phenomenon occurs, but rather that it's often overinflated and is seen as the all-encompassing identifier of who we are as human beings, as people. So when your sexual attractions and your sexual orientation and activities then becomes the basis for what defines you as a person. In other words, if you're attracted to something, that's your definition as a human being. What you're attracted to sexually defines you as a person. And I find that to be problematic. Because we are more than just sexual desires and attractions. We are human beings who are made in the image of God. And so when we put an emphasis on your sexual identity as the means which defines who you are, then we have given that a place that I think is exaggerated and too much. People are not defined by what they like. There's more to it than that. So sexual identity is a rather recent development as well. It's interesting. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and so I can remember life without computers and cell phones, rotary dials. there's just a different world. And even then, my world was very different from my parents' world and on and on. But one of the things that has always impressed me as I've gone on in my studies and whatnot, is the history of ideas. Because there's some ideas that I've had, even growing up as a teenager, that I just assumed to be givens, that it's always been the way it is. And then when you start studying the history of ideas, you begin to see that, wait a minute, this idea has actually not been around forever. In fact, it's only 100 years old or so. And sexual identity is one such thing. The rise of the concept of sexual identity actually has an identifiable beginning point. Once again, Paris writes, the labels heterosexual and homosexual emerged in the late 19th century by medical doctors who are the only ones using those terms. Moreover, both types of people were considered by these doctors using the terms, so they were classifying terms. Homo and heterosexuals were both classifying terms only used by doctors at the late 19th century to describe people who were deviants. And what they mean by this is they were pursuing sexual desire without a concern for procreation. So homosexuals were seen as people with people of the same sex. Heterosexuals were seen with people of the opposite sex, and then sometimes both. And so, in other words, these terminologies that came out were descriptives of, once again, people not connected to some sort of normal practice, but they were seen as deviants. She goes on to say that heterosexual was a medical term used in the 20th century and not used in everyday parlance till 1930. To be heterosexual, and by the way, the chapter in this book is called The Problem with Heterosexuality. She said, to be heterosexual then requires people to believe something about themselves in a cultural context that recognize heterosexual as a meaningful role. Right? In other words, to use the terminology and to use it and apply it in such a way, you have to say that means something defining about who you are socially. He says heterosexuality in that sense did not exist in Grandpa's day. Just being a man summed it up. Sexual feelings and attractions had to be managed, but his fundamental framework would have been cast the issue in terms of sin and virtue, like other early Christian thought. He would not have linked sexual feelings to human identity as we do today. Paris goes on to say, you see, sexual identity in the Western 19th century formulation of what it means to be human. It is grounded in a belief that the direction of one's sexual desires is identity constituting. Earning an individual label as gay, lesbian, straight, and a social role that goes along with it. They perceive it as an innate and stemming from an inner desire that sexual identity must be searched out, found, named, and then expressed in order for each person to be a fully functioning adult and happy. Finding our sexual feelings is part of how we come to know ourselves and present ourselves to others. So heterosexuality is a sexual identity category, and because people believe in it, it has real social and personal impact. but it's an idea that came from somewhere. Now, in her chapter on homosexuality, she writes this. And I apologize for the lengthy quotes, but I want to kind of frame these important questions. And so I'm shifting away from understanding who you are as a human being by what your sexual desires are, to who you are as a human being made in the image of God, which is a very important foundational part for framing the conversation. She says, like heterosexuality, homosexuality is an idea that has a history, and it may be quickly becoming history insofar as homosexuality has been replaced by more specific terms such as lesbian, gay, bisexual. Newer categories, however, retain the premise that sexual feelings warrant a corresponding social identity. In this sense, all sexual identity categories have a common trouble. They tell us what a person wants is an important measure of who the person is. So today, same-sex sexuality is studied in all kinds of disciplines, sociology, anthropology, psychology, and people of same-sex attraction are less often labeled homosexual as though they constitute a subspecies of human. Though many Christians continue to use the term homosexual, the word is often being rejected today, in part because groups believe that there's more categories than that. So sexual identity categories are branching out. So when I use the LGBTQI and each one stands for something, right? Lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, and intersex, there's actually a number of others. So it's actually being broken down even further. It's not just, is one attracted to the same sex? Is one even, I mean, now asexuality is added to that category, right? People who don't identify sexually as all, or pansexuality, or all these other ways of identifying themselves. Rosario Butterfield says this, the concept of sexual orientation was first used by Freud. Everything goes back to Freud. It's Freud's fault. And she said it was first used by Freud, and its effect, if not intent, was to radically resituate sexuality from a biblical creational context to something completely new, the foundational drive that determines and defines human identity. Nothing short of personhood is at stake. By defining humanity according to sexual desires and segregation, its gendered object. You know what? I'm gonna skip a quote down to the one that I think is the most important one for this. Okay, so she talks about romanticism. She talks about the history of where these ideas come from and how it then frames a new understanding of humanity. But she talks about how the words changed. Now, here it is. This is an important observation that she makes. You see, with the shift, with sexual identity and homosexuality and all these other words coming into being, the word, right, shifted sexuality from a verb, something that you do, to a noun, something that you are. Now hear me on this. The shift from verb, an activity, a practice, to a noun, a person, is huge. And you can't miss the impact of that, because now it's not a matter in this shift. Now it's seeing that what you do and what you desire and what you want sexually then defines everything about who you are as a person. And then to say then, now hear me on this, to say that's sinful. They don't understand that the love the sin, hate the wait a minute. Scratch that. Hate the sin and love the sinner. Well, it's time to go. But within that, what's missing there, right, is what I desire sexually is who I am as a person. That can't be separated. So there's no separation of my sexual desires and practices and preferences from who I am as a person, because that is me. And to deny that is to deny me. And so this shift, all of this is to say that we are more than that. I have a number of other points to make about all of this, but if I could, I'm gonna skip ahead to this, and I'm gonna finish off with this morning. Mark Yarhouse, who's a Christian psychologist, has done a lot of studies on sexual identity and counseling, identifies a number of factors that define our sexual selves. And he says biological sex, right, the chromosomes, genetics, gender identity, a sense of masculine or feminine, sexual attraction, what one is attracted to, intention. Now, this is an important one. Intention is, right, what you intend to do. Just because you intend to do something doesn't mean you end up doing it, right? Opportunity versus not. So sexual self-concept, sometimes there's opportunity, sometimes there's not. So someone might intend to do something, but they don't have the opportunity for it, so it doesn't happen. Sexual behavior, what one actually does. Volition versus non-volition, do you want this or not? And valuative, those are the things that are forming our core beliefs of values, of who we are. And this is from my colleague that I teach with, so I borrowed his material on this, but it makes a point, right? So we use the term sexual self as opposed to sexual identity. But all of these factors kind of go into how we see ourselves in that way. And so biological sex, gender, attraction, intention, behavior, value. The problem is, it's not always that neat. Sometimes there's other things that play into that, right? So for value, sometimes one's belief system, their faith community, all these other things play a dominant role in how they view their sexuality. Whereas other things like behavior are minimized. That's not so important, but value and attraction may be the dominant things, right? Others may be other people's opinions. You know, it's amazing. I was having lunch with a student a couple years ago. He was a student I got to know. He was about to graduate. We were eating lunch together, and when the students get to know me, they don't know how to refer to me, so they just call me Bandy. They don't want to use my first name because that's too informal, and they don't want to say doctor because that's so formal, so they just say Bandy. And we're sitting there over tacos, and he says, "Bandy, I don't get you." I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "I don't know what you are." I said, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "Where I come from, somewhere in central Oklahoma, there's only two types of guys. There's sports guys and there's car guys." And he goes, "You're definitely not a sports guy. And you're not a car guy either." And I looked at him, I said, "Well, you're leaving out one option." He said, "What?" I said, "How about the arts? You know, literature, movies, culture." And he laughed at me. And he said, "What are you, gay?" And see, right? Part of the frustration is that there are other people that say, "Listen, if you're a boy and you don't play sports, there's something off about you. Or if you're a girl and you're into hunting and working on cars, they might say, well, there's something off about you." And so sometimes it's what culture around us tries to tell us who we are, because we don't quite fit exactly in the stereotypes that they have imposed on us. And these are the types of things that we face on a daily basis. We were talking about this in class, and I shared that story about that student saying he didn't know what I was. And one of the girls, and she was from another country, she spoke up, and she was an athlete, very, very tall girl, athlete, and she spoke up and she just said, "I've been told all my life because of my size that I'm a lesbian because I can't, there's no way I'm just a normal girl." And she's like, "I don't have those feelings, but everybody I grew up with assumed and told me this is what I am." So sometimes informing our sense of sexual self, things like other people's opinions play heavily into that, right? Sometimes it's the experiences that we have or other such things, right? So there's different ways that different people, based on their history, based on the experiences that they've had, have developed different ways of conceiving themselves, and different factors play into that. Well, I feared that I would not be able to get through everything, and so I designed my talks in terms of I can slice it off at any time and pick it up the next day. Where I really wanted to get to today and where we'll start tomorrow is I wanted to make sure that we situated everything in an understanding of God made man in his own image, and he made them male and female. And so rooting our understanding in what it is to be an image bearer of God. And I say this for this reason. At my university, I encounter a lot of students struggling with same-sex attraction. I've gone to places and there's trans, and there's other people. I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, and I had friends that were same-sex attracted and so forth. And here's the thing that I want to emphasize. They are human beings first. And that's where I want to locate our understanding, is that we are all human beings first and foremost. And so what one desires or identifies as sexually is secondary to what it means to be a human being. So we'll pick up there tomorrow, if you'll let me come back. We'll get into the biblical material in the morning. Let me close in prayer. Lord Jesus, I want to thank you for your grace, your goodness. Lord, we have this awesome task of trying to work through these difficult topics. And for some people, that may be not that important, but for other people, it may be imminently important. Lord, help us to be able to think and understand about what it means, first and foremost, to be a human being, and then what your word speaks to us about these things. Lord, I pray for anyone here who may be struggling or just dealing with things. Lord, I pray that your grace would overflow in abundant ways, that we would know you and experience you even in the midst of these struggles. In your name we pray, amen. Thank you.
We hope you found this message a blessing to your life. More Columbia International University Chapel messages are available at iTunes and at podcast.ciu.edu. Learn more about CIU's undergraduate, seminary, and graduate programs at our website, ciu.edu. Columbia International University educates people from a biblical worldview to impact the nations with the message of Christ. Thank you for the opportunity to minister to you today.